This is the KPTZ Compass, your local news magazine for the Northeast Olympic Peninsula. This week on the Compass, we talk with award-winning journalist Dar Jamail about his new book titled The End of Ice, for which he circled the globe to document in devastating detail the heartbreaking realities of runaway climate disruption. So now, let's go inside the Compass. So I'm sitting here today with Dar Jamail, who has just come out with, I think what I have to say is one of the most devastating books I have ever read. Because, well, the title is The End of Ice, but really I think it should be titled more like The End of the World as We've Known It. Dar has gone to the four corners of the planet, seeking out the places where climate change has had its most dramatic and disruptive effects on people and on environments, on whole ecosystems, and has witnessed firsthand collapsing ecosystems and people who are losing their livelihoods and their cultures. And so, anyway, welcome, Dar.
Thanks, Steve. Good to be with you.
Why don't we start sort of at the beginning? You lived in Alaska for quite a while, and the book literally starts with a cliffhanger. and I've thought a lot about sort of the symbolism of you swinging, just barely being held on by your partner in a crevasse, and you're literally depending for your life on this great mass of ice. Why did you start the book there?
Well, it's because Alaska was where I was living. I moved up there in 1996 and got into mountaineering straight away. And so that's really where this book began for me, because I was, you know, it was in our face up there with the Arctic warming twice as fast as the rest of the globe, that back then it was immediately apparent, and I had done zero research, but, you know, it doesn't take a genius to understand the glaciers are receding dramatically when there's no snow on the ground in Anchorage in Christmas, when temperatures are going up and everything's hurdy-gurdy, that something is gravely amiss. So that's what happened. So I decided to start the book there because of that, and then also that experience in the ice of some part of me then, even though it still predated the beginning of my real climate change research as a journalist, some part of me really knew in the immediate aftermath of that event that I was already starting to grieve for what I was witnessing happening on the planet.
And what you were witnessing was the glaciers receding. The first chapter is about what you saw in Denali, where you were a mountaineer, and I guess you did like backcountry rescue work there too.
Right. So one of the things I was doing up there on Denali, and this is right before I went over and started reporting from Iraq, was first as a just general climber, then as a mountain guide, and then I volunteered with the National Park Service doing rescue patrols up on the mountain. And so I'd done several of those. And so I managed to do another one in 2016 for the book and go up with one of the people that I had climbed with back when I still lived up there, and write about anecdotally, as well as bringing in some science of the dramatic changes happening up there. I mean, for example, the Kehiltna Glacier, the glacier you spend most of your time on when you climb the standard route on Denali, is melting dramatically. That literally it's lost so much volume of ice that one of the stories I share in the book is how my friend Mike Shane, the ranger that I was with on this patrol in 2016, told me that several years prior to that, he and a bunch of people had gone down from base camp and found a rock climbing route up off the glacier. And then they went down there again several years later to repeat the same route. And at first they thought they had trouble finding it, and then they looked up on the rock and they realized that the starting point was about 30 feet up the glacier, and that's how quickly they're melting. Another person, Tucker Chenoweth, who is another mountaineering ranger there, talked about how the camps on Denali are referred to as their elevation. So base camp 7,200, it's camp 2, 78, 11,2 camp, 14,2 camp, 17,2, et cetera, et cetera. And he said most of these, especially the ones from 11,2 down, things are melting so quick that literally that elevation is no longer accurate. So we're going to have to figure out what to name the camps instead.
I suppose a lot of people might ask themselves, you know, well, what does it matter? I mean, you know, glaciers, they're just kind of like, you know, wastelands up there at the top of mountains. And, you know, like what use are glaciers?
Well, if we look at the loss of glaciers in one region of the Himalaya alone, which is the source of 7 of the major rivers in Asia that provide drinking water and irrigation for 1.5 billion people. So if those are gone, that's going to be a little bit of a problem. Right now at present, 250 million people rely on glaciers as their sole source of drinking water. So what happens when they're gone for those people? What happens to us here in you know, right here on the Olympic Peninsula? How much of our water, our groundwater and our irrigation water come from these glaciers that, according to scientists I interviewed for the book and several other scientists, these glaciers will not be here by 2100. None of them. So what happens to our water then? So people can think about it that way. And then from a natural perspective, I got a deep understanding spending time with a couple of the people I interview in the book about what glaciers do, the service they provide for the valleys where they're located, for example. So they regulate the temperature of streams wherein certain fish live and insects, that if that glacier is gone and the temperature of that stream rises, then those species can't live there. And then what happens to everything that eats and relies upon those species, et cetera, et cetera. So you can see the cascade that it sends through the ecosystem. If a glacier vanishes, it regulates the entire temperature of the valley. Of course, the water source that they provide. So when that water source diminishes or evaporates entirely when the glacier is gone, it's going to change the entire vegetation system of the valley. And again, everything that previously relied on it to be a certain way when the glacier was there, all that's going to change and most of it's going to go away. So when we lose glaciers, we lose the entire ecosystems that are dependent upon them.
And that's just actually one small part of this book, because it's not just the glaciers. In fact, the oceans, much of the book actually focuses on what's going on in the oceans. Tell us a little bit about what's already happening in the oceans in the way of warming.
The oceans really are the big story of climate change, if not the biggest, certainly one of the biggest. They've absorbed 93.7% of all the heat that we've generated into the atmosphere. That's been absorbed into the oceans. And so it's causing dramatic shifts in the oceans. It's doing things like causing major coral bleaching events around the world to the extent it basically looks like there will be little to no coral left at current trajectories, probably long before 2050. And that includes massive impact on at least a quarter of the different species in all of the oceans, not even to speak of the role coral reefs play in the fish that people harvest for an important part of their nutrition around many parts of the globe. It's doing other things that the heat that is in the oceans, like causing dramatic melting in the Antarctic. So much of the melting now that we're seeing of the Arctic sea ice up in the Arctic and from what's happening in the Antarctic, which the most recent study that just came out right about the time when the book came out, coincidentally, showed that there's been a 6-fold increase of melting in the Antarctic just since the 1970s. And so much of this now can be attributed to the warming oceans. And to give people an idea of how much energy and how much heat the oceans have absorbed, that if they weren't there to absorb that heat, our atmosphere would currently be 97 degrees Fahrenheit hotter. That is how much energy has gone into them. So you can imagine the effect on species. This is why there's been part of the reason why another report, a scientific study has shown that there may well be no saltwater fish left on the planet by 2048. The massive species displacement is causing huge shifts within the ocean. itself. And so that's just some of the ways that the oceans have played this role as kind of being a governor of how intense the planet would warm. And the reality is, again, and this just came out recently as well, 2018 was yet again, for the fifth year in a row, the hottest year the oceans have ever seen. So clearly they continue to absorb heat, it's escalating, and that warming cycle is continuing.
And meanwhile, the sheet ice in the Arctic, I mean, you spend a couple of, both at the beginning of the book and at the end of the book, you visit Alaskan indigenous communities on the coast, and both of the villages you visit are in imminent danger of vanishing because of sea level rise. But perhaps most distressingly to the people who live there and their ancient cultures is the way the fur seals and actually, you know, like all of the species that they rely upon for their food, for their subsistence, are vanishing also.
Right. I went out to St. Paul Island in the Pribilofs in the middle of the Bering Sea with the goal of writing a chapter just to show how native populations are those taking it the hardest and the fastest on the chin, because primarily because they live closest to the earth, subsistence lifestyle, etc. So there's literally, if I remember the number correctly, 236 year-round residents on this little island, and it's heavily dependent upon subsistence lifestyle and fur seals, and then also commercial fishing. And what's happening, along with dramatic weather changes, more fierce storms, shifting seasons that's impacting the fishing industry and their harvesting on land. Along with that is the entire food web in that region, also primarily because of the warming oceans, again, that it's caused what one scientist told me is literally a break in the food chain, where you have this tiny little forage fish that is the base of the food chain. It's called the sand lance, and it is becoming toxified by toxic algae that's a result of the warming waters that it lives in. And then its toxicity is then being sent up the food chain, because as everything else eats it, and then the bigger things eat those things, and that works its way up the food chain, we're seeing these crashes in wildlife populations up there, in fish, in birds. We've seen massive die-offs of mer seabirds, and then the decline of food available for fur seals. So one of the most heartbreaking things I ran into up there was a story that one of the elders on St. Paul told me, that mother fur seals are having to swim so much further and so much deeper out into the oceans to try to find food for their babies, that by the time they get back to the rookery with the food, their babies have died of starvation.
That's awful. And then there's the forests of the world. It's impossible to escape noticing now. I mean, when you talk about climate change locally, August, September have become the smoke months,
right?
The fire months. In like British Columbia, you know, in rainforest, in what is supposed to be one of the wettest places in the world, it's shocking. It's unheard of. And if we talk about what happened in California, paradise, it turns out to be really ironically named.
That's right. That's right. And yeah, I did devote an entire chapter just to the trees, because it's easy to overlook. That's not, aside from the forest fires, it's not as overtly catastrophic, you know, and dramatic as things like sea level rise and some of these other overt climate change impacts. But the reality is, it's the trees are in big, big trouble. With drought becoming more prominent around the world, studies that have come out, I cite one of them in the book that talks about, you know, if we have these massive forest fires in Siberia, with everything being so deeply interconnected, that's going to affect trees and climate systems over here and vice versa. So basically science proving what indigenous populations have long since known. And so the trees, you know, some of the ramifications of the warming, obviously forest fires, obviously drought, but also we have, you know, the bark beetle and different types of beetle infestations that are literally wiping out trees. And we're starting to see this even here now in the Olympics. We were protected from it for a while, but we're starting to see larger and larger areas where beetles are taking out large swaths of forest. And this is extremely dramatic in parts of British Columbia and other parts around the American West, but we're even starting to see it right here, where, as you said, we've been so largely protected from it because of so much moisture and rainfall, and we haven't seen up until the last few years these dramatic droughts, but it is starting to hit here. I remember back in 2015, by May, when Governor Inslee declared a statewide drought emergency, you know, and here we are in the Pacific Northwest. I mean, that's understandable on the other side of the Cascades. When we start seeing that here, which really, if you look at the climate change models into the future, the NASA projections, for example, this is one of the best areas to live in the contiguous 48 up until 2100. We have, you know, this maritime climate. Things are kind of buffered because we live so close to the ocean, because of our latitude, because of the amount of rainfall we get here. And so while this is one of the milder areas to live as far as overt impacts, we are already seeing some pretty dramatic impacts. And I think one of the ways that expresses itself the most obviously is within the trees.
And I think briefly wanted to touch on the Amazon.
Right. So I had the privilege of going to the Amazon rainforest. It's the single biggest rainforest on the planet. There are so many species there of trees, insects, birds, animals, you name it. It's mind-bending. And the broad brushstrokes of the Amazon with climate disruption is that it plays a critical role in the climate system of sequestering carbon. You know, the nutrient-rich, dense soils, the canopy, the trees itself takes down so much CO2 from the atmosphere. It literally acts as a giant carbon sink. I mean, all forests do this, but the Amazon particularly. And what's happening, though, as temperatures increase, coupled with human encroachment, coupled with wildfires, there's this myriad impact from these issues where there's already been periods where, instead of sequestering carbon, the Amazon has become a net carbon producer. And so what does that do to the climate system, where you have the world's biggest rainforest that for millennia has sequestered massive amounts of CO2 out of the atmosphere? As it's drying up and burning up and heating up, it starts releasing more and more of that into the air. And some of the current projections of temperature increase, which right now, if we had as close to a full stop of fossil fuel emissions around the planet as possible, we are looking at best case scenario, probably still seeing a 3°C increase, period. There's no way around this, because you're not going to remove the heat from the oceans. And so that means at a 3°C increase, approximately at least half of the Amazon is gone. And so what does this mean then as far as its sequestration ability, et cetera? Not even to talk about the importance of biodiversity. We have to remember how much of our pharmaceuticals come from the Amazon. And even more importantly, how many species there are yet to be discovered. I mean, they are still to date discovering a new species there at least every other day.
None of the signs are good. It looks like we've probably passed various tipping points and come to the point. I mean, one of the most terrifying facts comes towards the end of the book. You talk about the Permian extinction event, which was the largest one in our geologic past. And it seems like it was probably triggered by a sudden methane release, such as, and so why don't you tell me what is the ticking time bomb that might be waiting for us that just sends us way over any kind of prediction?
That extinction event occurred 252 million years ago, and most scientists believe that it was caused by a giant amount of volcanism in Siberia that released enough CO2 to warm the atmosphere several degrees, at which point the oceans warmed and the subsea permafrost that held stored within it a massive amount of methane hydrates. Methane's a 100 times more potent greenhouse gas than CO2 on a 10-year time scale. And then once all that's released, that was really the final trigger of the Permian mass extinction, which killed over 90% of all species on the planet. And what we have, that occurred over 80,000 years. What we have done in the roughly 250 years since the Industrial Revolution began is we have emitted so much CO2 into the atmosphere that the last time literally there was this much CO2 in the atmosphere, seas were between 60 and 70 feet higher than they are today. So we are literally just waiting for the Earth to catch up to what we've already done to it. And so what is so disconcerting is that we have literally recreated the conditions that caused the Permian mass extinction. What hasn't happened yet en masse is the methane hydrates that are, again, frozen in the subsea permafrost in the shallow seas of the Arctic. That is starting to release now, and I write about this in the book. There's several studies that show this, but we're waiting for, could there be a cataclysmic release of a massive amount of this happening all at once? Natalia Shikova, a scientist who was working at the University of Alaska Fairbanks at the time, has warned of a giant methane burp or giant instantaneous release of huge stores of this all at once that would literally add half again as much carbon equivalent as what we've already put into the atmosphere, which, you know, the catastrophic cascade of changes that would follow that would be on the level of something along a science fiction movie. And that's, it's so distressing because having been up in that region and talked with the experts and seen for myself how quickly the permafrost is thawing out on land, as well as talking to the scientists studying what's already happening with methane releases underneath the Arctic Ocean, is it's already here. It's already happening. We haven't had the massive abrupt release, but every year now we're seeing increases in the amount of methane coming up out of the Arctic. And NASA's actually been warning about this for years. And that is a extremely worrisome situation. And that, along with the warming oceans, and of course, they're deeply interconnected, those two playing off of one another. So that is something that I think we all need to be paying very close attention to right now.
This does not bode well for Port Townsend and every other like coastal place in the world. It puts a whole different face on urban planning.
It really does. And, you know, that really brings us back, you know, getting back into sea level rise. I interviewed Dr. Harold Wanless, leading sea level rise expert at University of Miami. And he said, look, our geologic history shows us that when we went in and out of the last ice age, that for every 100 CO2 100 parts per million CO2 that's added to the atmosphere, there's a corresponding 100 feet of sea level rise. And so I did the math and I asked him, I said, okay, so we've added roughly 130 parts per million CO2 to the atmosphere since the Industrial Revolution. And so that means we could, in theory, at least be looking at 130 feet of sea level rise. And he said, yes, that's accurate. So, and even well before we get to that, I mean, if we just look at the fact that most likely, I mean, the current NOAA worst case prediction for sea level rise by 2100 is 8.5 feet. Many of the people like Wanless I spoke with laughed, said they think that's absurdly low, that we're going to be much higher than that. He cited a James Hansen study that said we could see 10 feet by 2050, as in 31 years from now. And what's interesting, you know, we talk about global response, but I think global response can actually be encapsulated by what we've seen right here in Port Townsend, where this city decided to dump how many millions of dollars into an infrastructure project underneath Water Street, which is what, maybe 6 feet elevation sea level rise? How many millions of dollars into, you know, the sewage and the electrical and whatever else they did down there? Let's contrast that response to what the Quileute and the Macaw tribes are doing, where they're actively moving low-lying villages higher uphill. Which of these scenarios makes more sense as a response to climate change?
I think that's pretty clear. Well, we're about to run out of time, but your book is subtitled Bearing Witness and Finding Meaning in the Path of Climate Disruption. And I never really thought about that term, bearing witness, before, but it's like bearing a burden. It's a huge burden that you've been bearing. I know, because just in the like couple of days that I've read this book, I'm feeling this like sickly anxious
it's grief. I'm experiencing grief, and you talk about grief in the book. But you've been living with this for several years as you like go around the world and visit all these places. I mean, how have you borne that grief?
Well, it is bearing witness. I think is the burden of it's all of our burden now, and we're going to whether we like it or not. And I suggest doing it willingly, in order to start dealing with the grief, the anger, the sadness, the fear, the frustration, the rage, it what's caused this, including our own behavior personally. And for me, the first time I wrote a big article that really, I did a deep research and really connected all the dots of what's happening and really got the gravity of our situation and that we are really off the cliff and we're going into a completely new era was 6 years ago. It was late 2013 when I wrote this article. And I went into a big depression for quite a while and struggled a long time and watched myself going in and out of denial and, oh, well, maybe there's still time and blah, 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 and really grappling with it and sometimes not dealing with it well at all. Really, it's been this long journey and a long process. And this book, I think, culminated it for me of going to these places and getting my heart broken, watching the loss and understanding deeply what's coming and seeing it in the faces of a lot of the scientists that I went out into the field with and coming to this point of what do I do? And it really got brought all the way down to me by talking with a couple of Native American medicine men, and one of which I feature at the end of the book, and getting into indigenous wisdom and stories and being reminded of the importance of really deeply reconnecting back into the earth. And a lot of these things are still here. So we still have glaciers. We still have beautiful forests. We still have functioning parts of the ecosystem and the biosphere. And as grim as things might look, I feel morally obliged to comport myself in the right way with the planet as a way of still finding out how can I best be of service to this planet and what can I still do to try to take care and protect what's here. That, you know, I really get into kind of deconstructing the idea of hope in the book because we are out of time and hope is a future paradigm of for something, or it's kind of a form of denial and not taking full responsibility for what's going on, because each of us now still has the capacity and agency to go do something to serve this planet. And how all this ends, nobody knows, despite how grim it looks. And do we not all still want to go do absolutely everything we can to try to serve this planet and help this place in whatever way we possibly can while there's still time?
With Dar Jamail, author of the newly released book, The End of Ice, Bearing Witness and Finding Meaning in the Path of Climate Disruption, this is Steve Evans for KPTZ Community Radio News. This was Compass was produced by Steve Evans. The Compass airs Mondays at noon and 5 p.m. and repeats the following Saturday at noon. You can listen to podcasts of past Compass programs at the kptz.org website, where you can also stream KPTZ live 24 hours a day. For the news team here at KPTZ 91.9 FM in Port Townsend, I'm Steve Evans.